Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 65. Listening to the Airline Pilot Guy Show, with a view from my side of the cockpit door. I'm Captain Jeff, your host, broadcasting live from Studio 313 at the Doubletree Hotel in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. In this episode, a hacker claims he can control a plane remotely with a smartphone. The FAA postpones tower closings until June. A Lion Air 737 crash in Bali, Indonesia. Air traffic controller saves a pilot over Colorado. Your feedback and much, much more. So get all settled in. Tray tables and seat backs in their upright and locked positions. Electronic devices powered on. Flight 65 is ready for pushback. Well, hello, everybody. First of all, let me apologize. I know I didn't get a show out last week, an episode, but it was a busy week flying, and then I went out to see my mom and sister out in California. And then had to come home and, didn't have to. I got to go home and be with my family and spend a couple days trying to, you know, do whatever needs to be done around the house, and then back out again on this trip. It's a 4-day trip. I'm on day 3 right now, and as I said in the show open, I'm in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. And let's see, this has been a busy week. On Monday night, the first layover, I stayed up to record an episode of a fantastic aviation podcast, and there's so many good podcasts out there, aviation podcasts. You should listen to them all if you haven't checked them out yet. Well, this one is called The Airplane Geeks Podcast. It's been running for a long time, and got a chance to record the show with Rob Mark and Max Flight, and had a great time. And that episode should be out sometime this week, perhaps today. I'm recording on Wednesday of this week, the 17th of April, I believe. 17th of April. And so look for that show if you want to hear me in a little bit different setting and kind of conversing with others about things going on in aviation. Yesterday, Tuesday, I was in Fort Lauderdale, and I met up with an Airline Pilot Guy listener, Chad, and he picked me up from the hotel. We went over to a place that we used to hang out a lot at a different hotel we used to stay in Fort Lauderdale. The place was called the Bahia Cabana or something like that. You know, nice, relaxed, laid-back place to have a beer and have a great seafood salad, as we did. And then it's Wednesday now, day 3 in Palm Beach Gardens, and the big deal is that I'm recording this episode. And for those of you watching the video podcast or the video recording of this, you already know. But for those of you listening, which is a majority of you, to the audio podcast, I'm doing something different, and I'm hoping to do this every time now. I'm kind of experimenting a little bit with video, putting this on YouTube. And it's, you know, nothing fancy, just me sitting here at my desk in my hotel room recording the show. So if you're interested in seeing what I look like, well, you already know. You probably have checked out my Facebook page and such. But if you want to see me while I'm recording the show, and you really have nothing better to do, then click on the link that I'll have in the show notes for the YouTube video. So, there. I think I've covered everything, so let's get on with the show. I got this from Nash in Hong Kong. He says, "Hi, Captain Jeff. Hope you're doing well. This is Nash, once again from Hong Kong. And I had shared a news item regarding an airline here in Hong Kong planning to give martial arts training to the cabin crew, and even a question for you in my previous mail. And by the way, that'll be in the feedback section of this of today's show. This particular email, he says, just heard of a brand new Lion Air Boeing 737-800 and taking a dip in the sea in Bali, Indonesia today. There are conflicting reports that the plane overshot the runway or came down after a failed effort of a go-around maneuver. I came across a YouTube link which gives a cockpit Airbus 320 view of a landing in Bali at that same airport. Hope it will give you a fair picture of what the terrain and the airport surroundings are like there for you to comment on the crash. And then he has the YouTube link, which I'll include in the show notes. He said, thanks for your awesome podcast. You're welcome, Nash, and thank you for sending in the feedback. And I apologize for not getting to your feedback in the last show, but I promise I'll answer your feedback question in this episode. But that leads us into the Lion Air 737-800 crash at Denpasar Airport in Bali. And basically the video that he shows of the Airbus 320 coming in for landing there, it's, you know, there is a high terrain on the island of Bali, but where that airport is situated, it's kind of on a very thin piece of land, ocean on either side. And so not a lot of terrain. It doesn't look that particularly demanding of an approach and landing at that airport. I believe the runway length is around 9,500 feet or so. This airplane, the Lion Air flight 904, was flying from Badung to Denpasar, Indonesia, with 101 passengers and 7 crew, and approached to runway 9, but came to a stop in the sea short of the runway. And the aircraft broke up in two parts. The good news is that all the occupants were evacuated from the aircraft and have been taken to hospitals with minor injuries. 46 people received medical treatment. 5 are still in the hospital, at least the following day after this crash. Nobody died. That's the good thing. Except the airplane, which is sad because it's a brand... I mean, literally, this airplane had been delivered to Lion Air just a couple of weeks ago, and it is brand spanking new. Beautiful airplane, which I'm sure is just totaled. It's broken into at least 2, maybe 3 pieces. So I'm sure that they're not going to be able to use that airplane again, which is really, really a shame. And you said, well, it looks like it either overran or maybe crashed on a go-around maneuver. Well, neither of those, actually. It was approaching the airport from the opposite direction of that video that you sent me. They were coming in on 27. The accident flight, the Lion Air flight, was coming in from the west, landing to the east. And they got to a certain point, and then all of a sudden they just dipped down and hit the water short of the runway. So they actually never made it to the runway. Some people talk about, if you read the comment section in the Aviation Herald, which is one of the sources I use for getting my news information, it's interesting because, it's interesting for a lot of reasons. But one of the things was mentioned that the airplane was slightly below a 3-degree glide path, and then people were assuming that that means that there was some kind of a precision approach, but there isn't. The other direction, 27, they have an ILS, which is an instrument landing system approach. Coming in from this direction, it's a VOR approach, which is a non-precision approach. Now, I'm not sure if Lion Air uses CANPA procedures, C-A-N-P-A, which stands for, constant angle non-precision approach procedures, which is what we use now at Acme Airlines. And I know a lot of the European carriers use the same kind of procedure, which basically takes a non-precision approach and turns it into a much more controlled, almost kind of a semi-precision approach, using a derived decision altitude and a derived glide path, so that you are coming down at a constant rate. And then if you don't see the airport environment and you're not in a position to land safely, then you can go ahead and perform a missed approach procedure. Which is very much like what you would do on a precision approach. And so I don't know if they were doing that style of VOR approach or if they were doing what we used to do, all of the airlines used to do years ago, which was something that we kind of term dive and drive. And that means you're at the final approach fix at a certain altitude. You pass the final approach fix, time, turn, throttles, twist, track, talk. For those of you in the military, you recognize the five T's. And you start on down at a higher rate than you would if you were doing a precision approach. 1,000 feet per minute or so, maybe even more, depending on how much altitude you had to lose in a whatever the distance is. And then you get down to the minimum descent altitude, the MDA, and you'd level off. And then you'd be down, low, looking for the airport environment and hoping that you see something so that you can continue from that point on a safe, nice, stabilized glide path to the runway. So again, dive and drive is the way we used to do it. Maybe some people are still doing it. I don't know if Lion Air does that or not, but that might have been a factor. I don't know. For those of you out there who know something about flying for Lion Air, maybe you can chime in with what you know about that. Let's see. The weather there was something that people are mentioning that that may have been a factor. It could have been there are reports that passengers say that they saw a wall of rain. Could have been a microburst. The METAR for that time frame was showing, it's at 0700 Z. Winds were 090 at 6 knots, and the ceiling was 1700 feet broken. Temperature 30 degrees Celsius, which is about 86 degrees Fahrenheit. And then the next observation, 1/2 hour later at 0730 Zulu, the winds are showing 150 degrees at 6 knots, but it's varying anywhere from 110 to 270, so it's swinging wildly. And the ceiling is still 1700 feet. They're mentioning cumulonimbus clouds, so a little bit of convective activity. And the temperature is the same. So it could be that there was some kind of a rain shower or perhaps a thunderstorm very close to the field that they entered, and then they got into a big downdraft, and that kind of threw them into the water. I don't know. I mean, if there was really something like that, it seems to me that they would have gone around because you can't see the runway in the airport environment, I guess. I don't know. I wasn't there, obviously. So we'll just have to see what the investigation brings up. But one of the things that I noticed when I was reading the comments about this crash is that, first of all, Lion Air has had a bad reputation. It's an Indonesian carrier. They have been banned because of their high accident rate from the European Union, and they have also been banned from operating in the United States. And in fact, when they take delivery of their airplanes, they have to do some kind of a loophole where Boeing basically hires their pilots so that they're not technically outside of the United States, so they can fly the airplane from Boeing's plant and fly it out to wherever they're going, to Indonesia or whatever. So to get around that ban from flying in the United States. The other thing that I noticed was that there was a mention of something that I had not heard of prior to reading about it in this accident investigation. I don't know if they're still doing it, but Lion Air at least was one of the airlines out there that used something called pay to fly, P2F. And apparently when I was talking with Chad last night, he said, oh yeah, that a lot of airlines do that. And that's sometimes the only way that pilots out there can get any kind of experience, the kind of multi-engine airline kind of operational experience. And what it means is basically what it says, pay to fly. Instead of the airline hiring you to fly for them and paying you and giving you benefits, you actually pay them for the opportunity to fly for their airline. So you get the idea there that you have people there that may not have a lot of experience that are occupying the first officer's seat, and they are not making any money at all. And then I've read some instances where they're treated quite badly by a lot of these airlines. For instance, at Lion Air, somebody was writing that he is an expatriate, an expat, and flies for the airline, and they're basically treated like trash. Apparently that's something that's worth doing to build up your time and have experience in a 737 or a Airbus A320 or whatever, so that you can move on with your career and get hired by a different airline. So that's interesting. If you're listening right now, if you know anything about pay to fly and what, you know, you have any experience with that, let me know, because again, that's something that I had never heard of. There's an outfit down here in South Florida, down in Miami, called Eagle Jet International, I believe, that kind of coordinates this thing, and they have a table on their website of how much money it's going to cost you to apply and to get a certain number of hours, and then there's another price for, you know, hours beyond that basic level. Anyway, it's just an interesting system. And some people call it a scam, but I'm not going to say that because, you know, honestly, I've never heard of it before. I don't know anything about it. So, may be a factor, may not be a factor in this particular crash. I don't know. So it turns out that the captain in the accident flight had 10,000 hours. So I think that he was a relatively experienced captain, a lot of time in type as well. Okay, the other big story, which I'd love to talk about. Oh, you know what I should probably do? People always say that I should play some sound effects in between my stories, so let's do that. Okay, you saw it on your local news. You saw it on the national news. A lot of people making a lot of this, and that is something called the hack in the box. At a security conference in Amsterdam last week, a man who is a security consultant for a German company, N.Runs, I think. Let's see, I had it written down here somewhere. But now I'm having trouble seeing the actual text because it's being covered up. Why is that? Well, anyway, here, let me open up my window. There we go, I can see the whole thing now. The gentleman's name is Taso. Let's see, Hugo Taso. He's a security consultant at N.Runs in Germany. And at the Hack in the Box Security Conference in Amsterdam, he presented something called Aircraft Hacking, a Practical Aero Series. According to the abstract, this presentation will be a practical demonstration on how to remotely attack and take full control of an aircraft, exposing some of the results of my 3 years of research on in the aviation security field. The attack performed will follow the classical methodology, divided in discovery, information gathering, exploitation, and post-exploitation phases. That's easy for other people to say, not me. The complete attack will be accomplished remotely without needing physical access to the target aircraft at any time, and a testing laboratory will be used to attack virtual airplane systems. So before his presentation, Taso recommended that people should have a little background knowledge on aviation and aircraft systems to better understand what he was going to explain. So here are a few important facts. He talks about Automated Dependent Surveillance Broadcast, ADS-B. That system, which is, by the way, part of the next-gen system, several airplanes out there are already using this technology, and modern airliners will be implementing it as well. Several already do use it. It has no security, as was pointed out at a DEF CON 20, shortly before a hacker was able to inject ghost planes onto radar. It is unencrypted and unauthenticated. Let's see. The aircraft communications addressing and reporting system, you've heard me talk about that before. It's also called ACARS, also has no security, and it's used for exchanging text messages between aircraft and ground stations via VHF radio or satellite. Although his talk did not focus on the vulnerabilities in those two protocols, he used them to find targets. He says anyone with the right tools and a little know-how can read and send these ACARS messages. Now, that is a concern. You know, the fact that ACARS messages, and ACME uses ACARS primarily for communications, communications between our dispatcher on the ground, our maintenance people, getting information like digital ATIS, Automatic Terminal Information Service, you know, information about the airports and the approaches in use and the weather, weather information. When we send an in-range report to say, hey, we have five wheelchairs and we have two unaccompanied minors that need to be met at the gate, and this is when we're going to be there. You get the idea. It's a tool. It's a digital tool that we use for communicating with folks on the ground. Well, apparently there are some airplanes out there that have the capability of tying their ACARS unit with their flight management system, FMS. And now on the airplane that I fly, that doesn't happen. There's no connection there. There's no talking to each other. I did a little informal survey, talked to some 777 guys, talked to some Airbus guys yesterday. We deadheaded from New York to Fort Lauderdale yesterday afternoon. And so I poked my head in the cockpit and talked with those guys a little bit about this situation. And while some airplanes do have this capability of the ACARS actually updating flight plan information and such into the flight management system, there always has to be an acceptance of that change and an execution of that change. Now you might say, well, if a guy's able to break in to the ACARS system and the FMS system, then he probably has the capability of changing the code so that you can bypass the requirement for authenticating or even authorizing or executing a command. But even if that were so, I say that if you're sitting up there, you know, this is a situation today where we have pilots in the cockpit of these airplanes, although the automation is very high in many of these airplanes. We're still up there, and we're there because if something goes wrong, and trust me, automation does fail, and I've seen it fail several times. You have to be up there to control the airplane. Look at Air France 447. Automation failed, okay? The airplane that could not crash, it would not let a pilot crash. Well, guess what? The airplane crashed because all the protections that were built in didn't work because it went into a different mode that they never anticipated. And so that's why I always get on my soapbox, sorry for the sidetrack here, and talk about the fact that, hey, if you're a pilot out there, be a pilot. Even if you're flying an airplane that has a lot of automation, you have to be flying the airplane through that automation. You have to be thinking about what it's doing and know what to do when the automation fails. Okay, so getting back to this particular instance of hacking, you need to be aware of what is happening. And if you're sitting up there and all of a sudden the airplane starts turning and you're looking at your navigation display and say, why are we turning? Why did that route change? Et cetera. The immediate reaction would be to turn the automation off, fly the airplane manually. According to this guy, he says that he can like make the airplane crash by, making it come out of its cruise altitude and flying it down into the ground. But I tell you what, the way the systems work right now, until you have changed your altitude in the altitude alert window, that airplane is not going to do it. The automation will not do it because there are some things that you have to do to allow it to happen. So basically, you get the idea here. This guy is full of it. And I can't use the word I really want to use, so we'll just say he's full of hogwash or bull manure. How about that? So what he did is he went to eBay and he found a Rockwell or Honeywell flight management system unit. I guess it had been used in training or something. And then he used somebody told me he used X-Plane or some kind of a simulation software on the PC to kind of hook up with the FMS. He did some hacks, some exploits on it, and he was able to do all these things with this simulation software. Well, okay, that simulation software, while it is really, really pretty amazing how accurate it does and presents so many things, it's not the real thing. There are so many other safeguards that are in effect and differences from that on your PC and what we actually have available to us in the airplane. So the FAA, all the manufacturers of the FMS units, everybody's saying, that no, I'm sorry, but this may work on your computer, but it's not going to work on the airplane. Again, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to say that we shouldn't be worried about what this guy was able to do, because there are some security problems, some loopholes, some weak links in the system that need to be filled and taken care of. So anyway, he used his Samsung Galaxy and a specially crafted app called Planesploit to determine how to hack an airplane's computer. And the other one of the things I thought was crazy, here are some of the things that he has, some commands. Please go here, a way of interacting with a plane where the user can dynamically tap locations on the map and change the plane's course. Define area, set define filters related to the airplane. For example, activate something when a plane is in the area of X kilometers or when it starts flying at a predefined altitude. This is one that is not really funny at all. Visit ground, which means crash the airplane. The fourth item, kiss off, which is, removes itself from the system. And then finally, be punkish, a theatric way of alerting the pilots that something is seriously wrong. Lights start flashing and alarms start buzzing. Something also said in this article from this tech blog that I was reading is that he could drop the oxygen masks. Now, I spent several hours the past couple of days looking through all the different pages in the flight management system software, and there is no command in there to drop the oxygen masks. It has nothing to do with our flight management system. So, sorry, but that's not true. So I just had to talk about this, and of course the news made it sound like, well, okay, one more reason not to fly. Well, this hack, while interesting and it did expose some vulnerabilities in our systems, it's not as bad as people are making it out to be. And now, let's think about this. You know how I feel about drones. A drone aircraft, that aircraft is designed to fly without a pilot. There is no human up there to go, hey, what is this airplane doing? Okay, well, that is something that you should worry about. If this guy was able to hack into a system that have human pilots on board, think how easily it would be for him to hack into a drone and control the drone, because there's nobody up there to stop it. So, interesting stuff, and let's move on with another news story as I try to get my sound player here. Here we go. Okay. That didn't work very well, did it? Let's try that again. Okay, again, Boeing, Dreamliner, 787. Okay, what have you heard about this lately? Yeah, it's been suspiciously quiet, which is probably a good thing. Usually, in my experience, when two parties are negotiating something and you don't really hear much about it in the news, that usually means that something is probably getting ready to happen. And hopefully for Boeing, that's a positive thing. They completed the certification demonstration plan and flights a couple of weeks ago. They have compiled all the data. They've sent it to the FAA, and they are analyzing it and trying to determine whether or not the solution that Boeing has come up with is going to work, and whether or not they're going to sign off on it. Now, I read from another source that the reason why the FAA is really taking their time is that the head of the Department of Transportation, Ray LaHood, will be leaving soon, and that's what I read anyway, and this will most likely be his last big decision. And they already kind of dorked it up a little bit by certifying the aircraft with this technology, and I don't think he wants to make that mistake again. So I think they're really, really looking closely at this to make sure that everything is safe and sound and that they can recertify the airplane, get it flying again. And so, again, not much information from the FAA about what is going on with this solution. So stay tuned for further updates on that. And speaking of the FAA, of course, remember the last episode we talked about, really? I guess they're really going to close these towers. Well, right after I did that recording of that episode, the FAA came out and said, stop the presses. Hang on. We're not going to close these towers. Remember, they were going to close 149 small airports due to because of the sequestration, the government-wide spending cuts here in the United States. They decided to postpone this closing until mid-June. And the Federal Aviation Administration said it needs more time to deal with legal challenges to the closures. And specifically, about 50 airport authorities and other stakeholders have indicated... I skipped where I wanted to go here in the article. There are several groups that have begun lawsuits against the FAA for these airport closures. And they said that the main reason... Oh, here we are. Let's see. Airport operators in several states, including Florida, Illinois, and Washington State, and the U.S. Contract Tower Association, which represents the companies that operate contract control towers, have filed lawsuits with the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington seeking to halt the closures. The suits contend that the closures violated a federal law meant to ensure major changes at airports do not erode safety and unfairly targeted the program for an outsized share of the more than $600 million the agency is required to trim from the budget. So basically they're saying, hey, your procedures require you, by law, to do a study and to see what these changes are going to do to safety at these airports where you're going to close the towers. And so the FAA probably decided, you know what? They may be right. We didn't. We may have kind of jumped the gun on this. So let's take a couple steps back, kind of reanalyze this thing, because we don't want to be sued to oblivion. And you know what? I thought you couldn't sue the federal government, but apparently you can. So as I was about to say earlier, about 50 airport authorities and other stakeholders have indicated they want to fund the operations of the towers themselves rather than to see them shut down. And more time will be needed to work out these plans. In several places, as I mentioned last episode, in Texas, they said, hey, the state of Texas, we're going to pay to keep these 13 control towers open. I believe 13 were slated for closure in Texas. I believe the Sun and Fun in Lakeland, Florida, which happened last week, they actually got the money together privately to pay for air traffic control services. Now, of course, the towers didn't close, so maybe they didn't have to take the funds that they had raised for that. I think the number was something huge, like several $100,000 that they were going to need to pay the controllers to be there. But now that I'm thinking about it, they probably didn't have to do that because the FAA decided to postpone the closures. So, again, one of those interesting things happening here in the U.S. of A, the craziness with the money thing and or the lack of it and sequestration and all that jazz. So again, a lot of this is politics, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens here in the future, whether they really close those towers in mid-June or not, or if they postpone it again, whatever. So let's move on. Okay, now to Samoa. Hey, you may have heard this on the news, and everybody was just outraged about it. Outraged, I tell you. What is it they're outraged about? Well, this airline in Samoa, in the South Pacific, has decided to implement a new policy. And instead of charging a set price for a ticket to go from here to there, they've decided that, here, let me read what they put on their homepage of their website. Quote, "We at Samoa Air are keeping airfares fair by charging our passengers only for what they weigh. You are the master of your airfare. You decide how much or little your ticket will cost. No more exorbitant excess baggage fees or being charged for baggage you may not carry. Your weight plus your baggage items is what you pay for. Simple. Airplanes don't run on seats. They run on weight," Samoa Air's chief executive, Chris Langdon, told Radio Australia. So, how does this work? Well, you go to the section of the airline's website titled, "How does pay what you weigh work?" Step one, select Book online. Choose your flight. Step 2. Enter your details, including your estimated weights of passengers and baggage. Step 3. Your airfare is then calculated using your weight. Step 4. You travel happy, knowing full well that you're only paying for exactly what you weigh, nothing more. Okay, so again, I read from different places, heard it on the news and everything else, the outrage and how could they possibly do this? Well, let's get down to earth here and let's realize that Samoa Air, it sounds pretty official, right? Well, they are a real airline, but they only have 3 airplanes, 2 9-passenger reciprocating engine, twin engine airplanes, built in the 60s, by the way, and there's some kind of a British manufactured airplane, and a Cessna 172. Yes, a Cessna 172. Hey, you have an airplane out there, guys, a Cessna 152, 172, you too can start your own airline. Anyway, they just basically do those small little hops between islands in the Cessna 172 and these 2 9-passenger reciprocating twins. And so, you know, it's not like a really big deal, right? And actually, I'd heard, I have not verified this, but I've heard in several places people say that actually when the airline started up in the early 20th century, this is exactly the way you paid for your airfare, based on your weight, your body weight, and whatever you were carrying with you. Because, yeah, that is really what everything is based upon. We even, you know, when we put fuel on an airplane, we don't put gallons of fuel on the airplane. We put pounds of fuel because the weight of the fuel is what's important. Well, of course, the amount of fuel, the volume is important as well. You know, you want fuel there to keep the engines running, of course. Well, you know what I mean. So, interesting story from Samoa Air. And apparently a Norwegian airline is thinking about doing that as well, pointing to Samoa Air saying, see, these guys do it. They don't have a problem. Let's move on. Thanks to my friend Nilesh in India. He sends me several things during the week and weeks between episodes. The title of this is 300 Taxis Combine Their Headlights to Eliminate an Airstrip for an Emergency Flight. And this was at an airstrip in Peru. And apparently they had some sick people that needed to get to a hospital. And the only alternative besides flying in an airplane was to go on an 18-hour boat ride. And this airstrip is not designed for nighttime flying. It obviously doesn't have runway lighting. And so our local radio station sent out the request to its listeners to head out to the airport if you have a vehicle that has headlights in it. And a fleet of hundreds of taxis came to the rescue. And they lined up on the airstrip. And there's a YouTube video of this whole thing happening, which is really cool. I don't see the link right now in my notes, but if I can find it, I'll put it in the show notes. It's pretty cool. And this looked like a Cessna Caravan, something like that, using the runway for takeoff, and they successfully transported these 3 people. One person had some kind of a rare tropical disease called leptospirosis, and the other 2 passengers, one was a mother and her newborn baby. Well, I guess those are the other 2 passengers. The mother and the newborn baby were expected to fully recover. Not sure exactly what was going on with them, but the passenger that had the tropical disease later died from his complications due to that disease. But it's really cool to see something like that, for a community to come together and make it happen. So thanks, Nilesh, for sending in that story. And he also sent me this one, which is not so optimistic or uplifting at all. It's you hear about this every so often, a dead body found in landing gear of a plane that landed in France. This article I'm looking at here, I don't see it right here. It doesn't say what type of airplane, but it flew from Douala Airport in Cameroon in Africa. and officials at the Charles de Gaulle Airport discovered a man of about 30 years old, discovered in what officials described as a do-or-die voyage, hoping to escape poverty. Apparently, things are pretty bad when you're willing to risk your life like that. And you know what, folks? Usually these don't turn out well, because when airplanes are up at jet cruise altitudes, you know, 35,000 feet or whatever, the time of useful consciousness, because you don't have a pressurized compartment to ride in, it's there's no oxygen, and you basically starve your brain of oxygen, and you usually die of that. It's also really cold up there, like minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit. So turns out that most of the time, now there have been instances where folks have actually survived hiding in the wheel wells of airplanes and going for hours from point A to point B. Normally, usually, you don't survive. So that's kind of sad. So thanks for cheering me up, Neelish. Okay, let's do some more sound effects here. Okay, I'm not sure if somebody... Oh, yes, an anonymous listener sent this to me. A family traveling from Denver to Baltimore on United Airlines claims that their flight was diverted by the captain because the parents requested that the in-flight movie, Alex Cross, be turned off. The parents, thus far unnamed, wrote a letter to The Atlantic, which is a magazine, about the incident. According to the letter, after the flight took off, the flight crew lowered the TV screens and began playing the PG-13 rated cop thriller starring Tyler Perry. The parents, whose children are 4 and 8 years old, believed that the film was too violent for their kids. Alarmed by the opening scenes, they say, we asked two flight attendants if they could turn off the monitor. Both claimed it was not possible and would be a nuisance to the people behind them. At this point, according to the letter that they wrote to The Atlantic, the people behind the parents spoke up and said it would be fine with them if the movie screen was closed. Both flight attendants and later the purser claimed that they have no authority or ability to change or turn off the movie. The purser did, however, agree with us, as did many more of the passengers around us, that it is patently inappropriate to expose children to such content. And they said that they wrote that throughout the discussion, no voices were raised and everyone was civil and polite. The parents apparently accepted that the movie was going to be shown regardless of their request, and they attempted to distract their kids from the horrific scenes on the movie screens. Which makes what happened next so strange. So this happens, and then about, more than an hour later, remember this flight is going from, Denver to Baltimore, right? Yeah, Denver to Baltimore, a long flight. So more than an hour later, the captain announced that due to security concerns, our flight was being diverted to Chicago's O'Hare International Airport. Little did the parents know that they were the apparent cause for the diversion. Upon landing in Chicago, a police officer boarded the airplane and allegedly asked the family to gather their things and to disembark. The captain apparently felt that our complaint constituted grave danger to the aircraft, crew, and other passengers, and this danger justified inconveniencing his crew, a few of whom timed out during the diversion, and a full plane of your passengers, causing dozens of them to miss their connections, wasting time, precious jet fuel, and adding to United's carbon footprint. Not to mention, unnecessarily involving several of Chicago's finest, two border protection officers and several United and Chicago O'Hare managers, and an FBI agent, all who met us at the gate. After we were interviewed for less than 5 minutes, our identities and backgrounds checked, we were booked on the next flight to Baltimore and had to linger in the terminal for hours with our exhausted and terrified little boys. According to, The Atlantic magazine reached out to United's public relations team for a response. Spokesperson Charles Hobart responded, United Flight 638 from Denver to Baltimore diverted to Chicago O'Hare after the crew reported a disturbance involving a passenger. The flight landed without incident, and the customers were removed from the flight. We reaccommodated the customers on the next flight to Baltimore and have since conducted a full review of our in-flight entertainment. The parents are seeking an explanation for what they believe was a vindictive act on the part of the captain, as well as the airline's decision to show violent films around children. Interesting story. And again, I'm only seeing the facts presented to me in this article. So I don't know if there were some other things going on. You know, we're taking the word of the family, the lady that wrote this letter to the Atlantic magazine. They're claiming that they were calm, cool, and collected about this whole thing. It could be that the situation was really entirely different, and apparently the crew felt that it was important to remove them from the plane, and perhaps they felt it was a security concern. Now, if it was indeed, as the letter purports, a vindictive act by the captain, well, then that's not good. That's bad. And if that's the case, well, you know, I'm all about captain's authority, you know, exercising it, etc. But let's do it judiciously. Let's do the right thing out there. Let's don't overuse or misuse our power. So, again, I don't know if that's what happened here. I don't have enough details. I didn't talk to the captain to see really what happened. But interesting story. And let's see here. Oh, this is really, speaking of interesting, let's listen to this this air traffic control to pilot communications, this recording here. And this happened over the airspace over Colorado, I think Denver Center. And the air traffic controller is Luella Hollingsworth. And she's controlling this sector and has an airplane flying along in her sector at 27,000 feet in a Piaggio, a turboprop-powered twin, up at 27,000 feet, obviously a pressurized airplane. And let's listen to the conversation that she had with this pilot.
Advisor, One Papa Mike, I think you need to start a descent. Can you do that for me? Descend and maintain flight level 240.
All right. Can you hear you?
Okay, you can see that his language is very slurred. That's what kind of brought this whole thing to her attention. She was telling him or communicating with him or trying to communicate with him, and she was getting these slurred responses back from him, and that's just one of the exchanges that they had. And she realized, you know, something just doesn't sound right. And then other airplanes on the frequency also thought, what's going on here?
I don't know if you can hear that guy, but he does not sound good.
Okay, that was a pilot on another flight on frequency listening to that. And so she decides, something's wrong with this guy, so let me take some action here.
Air One, Papa Mike, if you got the oxygen, try that. Descend and maintain flight level 180.
Okay, so she gives him a descent, hoping that he's still conscious. And he descends, and then after a certain amount of time, getting into the more oxygen-filled environment, his brain starts functioning a little bit better, and then we hear him say this.
501 Papa Mike.
501 Papa Mike, you're sounding a little better.
Thanks for the help.
Okay. A happy ending. He did not crash, and apparently the airplane must have had a, I don't know all the details, the story, what happened mechanically with the airplane, whether the, he couldn't have been purposely operating without a pressurized airplane because he would have had to have been oxygen and he wouldn't have been at 27,000 feet. Apparently there was some kind of a leak in the pressurization of the airplane, and I don't know. I would think that those airplanes have systems like the airliners do where if the cabin altitude gets above 10,000 feet, a very obnoxious warning horn goes off, basically telling you, hey, you're above where you should be as far as the cabin altitude is concerned, and it's starting to get in the dangerous zone. And then if the cabin altitude gets even higher, then automatically oxygen masks are deployed from the overhead panels, and a rapid descent is commenced to get down into the part of the atmosphere where the oxygen the partial pressure of oxygen is greater. I have this chart here in front of me looking at the time of useful consciousness, and that's that time when you're in an environment where your altitude is a certain place, the time that you have before the oxygen to your brain just basically your brain just stops working very well. So, for instance, at a subject breathing oxygen at 27,000 feet at rest, so, you know, we pilots were at rest sitting in our seats, at 27,000 feet you have 1.5 minutes before you start exhibiting signs of hypoxia, which is that lack of, basically lack of oxygen in your blood that and doesn't feed enough oxygen to your brain. You know, I've talked about this on earlier episodes. It's very similar to when you're drinking. Hey, those of you out there who like to have a beer or two or three or four, the more you have, the more that alcohol displaces the oxygen molecules in your bloodstream, and you basically experience hypoxia. That's why you kind of get a little lightheaded, and sometimes if you drink too much, it's a little bit harder for you to think and react. Same thing happens when you are in a high altitude without oxygen. So that 27,000-foot altitude, if you're in a rapid decompression, it goes from 1.5 minutes to only 45 seconds. Let's keep going up. 36,000 feet. If you're just at rest, breathing normally, 30 seconds. If you are at rest at 36,000 feet and you have a rapid decompression, then you only have 20 seconds. So that's why when we get above 25,000 feet in an airplane and one of the crew members leaves their position to use the bathroom or whatever, the other pilot has to suck on the oxygen mask because if we lose pressurization at that point, especially a rapid decompression, the person that at the controls should already have that oxygen mask on their face so that they don't have to fumble around for it and risk the possibility of not getting it on in time before something terrible happens. So anyway, again, the air traffic controller, Denver Center, Luella Hollingsworth, she received the Medal of Safety. So job well done, Luella. And finally, wow, I've had a lot of news here. We're almost at an hour again. Wow. And I got a bunch of feedback, too, so I'll keep going here. This is something I wanted to talk about on the last podcast, didn't get to it. And I'm not sure if somebody sent me a link to this or if I found it on my own. I don't remember. But this is a situation, a YouTube video, which I'll have the link to in the show notes, that there's a Cessna 172 pilot with no training, no hours, only flight simulator experience. The video starts with a non-pilot with no previous instruction or flight training be able to take off, fly, and land a private plane based only on experience from a desktop flight simulator. And I have a little bit of an excerpt from that, the audio only, of course. And so let's listen to this guy. He's in his car. He's got his smartphone video camera on, and he's talking to the camera. So he's talking to us. So let's listen.
And then the next day on Saturday morning, tomorrow morning, I'm going to pick up a guy I met who's an airline pilot, and I'm going to go out to North Las Vegas airfield and get into a Cessna 172, which is a single-engine private plane, and try to take off and fly the airport pattern and come around and land it without any assistance from him. He's a certified flight instructor. He'll be sitting next to me, but no assistance from him and no advice, instructions. He'll just sit there, hopefully, quietly and see if I can do this. Thing is, makes it interesting is I have 0 hours of flight instruction, and I've actually never even been in a private plane, so should be challenging. Started off as a prop bet, and kind of has evolved into this challenge, so that's happening tomorrow. Should be very interesting. We'll see what happens.
Okay, so as you said, he's traveling, he's on the highway there, that's why all that road noise. And it started off as a, did he say a bar bet? So, hey, out there, if you're drinking, you know, be careful about what you bet at the bar. But apparently somebody said, yeah, you do your little rinky-dink PC flight simulator software thing. That doesn't mean that you can know how to fly an airplane. And he goes, oh, yeah, I'll bet I can. And so anyway, I'll have the link to the YouTube video so you too can see whether or not he did the task well or not so well. And I think you'll be entertained at least by what he does. So let's go over here and play our feedback stinger.
Captain.
Hi.
Incoming message.
Vice President Communications for WestJet. Today, we're announcing the easing of restrictions on pets in the cabin.
Who's this?
We recognize that a growing number of our guests want to travel with their extended family, and we're proud to be the first airline to offer this type of service. WestJet's new service, Furry Family, now allows for any type of animal that fits safely on board. What's more, we will no longer require animals to be kept in the kennels while they're traveling with us. After all, they're part of the family. WestJet's in-flight crews have received special training on how to care for the diverse family members we'll now be welcoming on board.
Okay, I actually did not mean to play that clip, but hey, since I accidentally hit it, and I did intend to talk about this, this was an April Fool's joke. So this video came out on April 1st. WestJet is one of the Canadian airlines, and they have this great video. Again, I'll put the link in the show notes to the video here. Very funny. It shows the cabin full of, you know, we see dogs and cats and that kind of thing in the cabin of airplanes in, you know, most of the time in some kind of a carrying case or whatever to keep it from roaming around the cockpit or the cabin. But in this video, they show like goats and ducks and all kinds of wild animals walking around the airplane, flying around the inside of the cabin, not in any kind of a kennel or box or anything like that. So I think that was kind of cute, their little April Fool's thing. So again, check out their very entertaining video. You'll find that in the show notes. So, let's get on with real feedback. So, let me get and open up my mailbag here, and let's start off with Steve King. And he says, no, not the author, not Stephen King. This is just plain old Steve King from Maryland. He says, I'm a relatively new member of the APG Army, or should I say Air Force, and I absolutely love the podcast, much to my wife's chagrin. It has rekindled my desire to work on earning my private pilot's license. Hey, Steve King's wife, I'm sorry. Really, I apologize. I didn't mean to make Steve interested in getting his private pilot's license again. Well, actually, I did. But okay, I have a few questions, if you don't mind, he says. Number one, I read a book written by a first officer where he wrote about a time when he was late departing and was rushed in the cockpit getting everything set properly due to an overbearing captain. Yes. Overbearing captains like me. No, I'm just kidding. He managed to get the last settings completed as they began to roll down the runway for takeoff. He said he had wished the captain would have said, let's slow down, get everything right, and then proceed when we are both ready. The first officer felt too intimidated to say stop. With your years of experience and your killer mustache, I'm in awe just seeing the picture. If I grew a mustache, my wife would think I have some dirt on my lip and would try to wipe it off. Hey, my mustache doesn't always look like this. I had one of those scraggly-looking things when I was younger. In fact, I had a big gap. You know, the two-part mustache with the no hair in the middle, right below your nose, in the middle there. But over the years, like everything else, hair grows everywhere now, places you don't want it to. And but the good thing is that filled in that gap. And well, let's don't talk. You guys don't want to hear about my darn mustache, do you? No, I don't want to talk about it anymore. Anyway, back to his email. I'm sure there are many first officers who may be nervous to speak up. Do you say anything during pre-flight like, stop me if you see something unsafe, or if you are unsure of something, speak up, to make them feel more comfortable, or is that all assumed? Well, to answer, unfortunately, as so many things in life, we tend to take things for granted. We tend to assume that the person that we're flying with, that they feel that they're going to say something about it. And honestly, 99% of the time, the guys that I'm flying, or gals that I'm flying with, are very experienced. They've been on the airplane for a long time. In fact, many of them have been on the airplane that I fly even longer than I have. So they're very experienced, and no need to, you know, say anything like that. But I do need to say something. And if I know that a person's with me and they've just checked out on the airplane, or they've just gone through training, and you can kind of tell when things are going a little bit more slowly than normal, that that this person may be new, I always try to say, hey, you know, as you suggested, you know, stop me if you see something unsafe, or if you're unsure of something, or hey, the thing I usually say is, look, if you feel like you're getting rushed, just let me know and we'll slow the whole thing down. Because as many of you know, in the flying world, it's a lot of hurry up and wait. So sometimes we kind of impose these false time constraints on ourselves. You know, we always want to move the mission. We want to make sure, you know, that the flight leaves on time, so it gets to where you're going on time, so you can get to the gate and not delay your passengers, and so they have a chance to make their connections. And you kind of have that time pressure on you, whether you're really thinking about it or not. And sometimes it takes somebody like a more assertive first officer to say, hey, do you mind if you slow down your taxi speed, or, you know, I'm not getting enough time to do all the things I need to do, and or if you could help me with this or whatever. So yes, it's important to realize that. And it's important for you first officers out there to not be afraid. And I know I was there, and I several times in my career when I was a flight engineer or a first officer felt very rushed and hoping that I got all the switches in the right position before we started the takeoff roll. So it is important to speak up and say, hey, look, slow it down. Let's breathe a little bit. Make sure we have the flaps set properly and all the things are, you know, complete, so we don't hurt anybody. So you make a good point there, Steve. Number two, do you see yourself retiring for good when required, or perhaps would you take a job with the NTSB given your analysis experience? People listening at the NTSB are going, what? Are you kidding? I don't want that guy working for us. Prima donna. No, you know, I'd love to. I am a trained and certificated flight accident investigation or investigator. Flight, that didn't sound right. Aircraft accident investigator and safety officer in the Air Force. I went through a 3-month long training program, pretty intensive actually, out at in Southern California. At the time, it was at Norton Air Force Base, which is no longer in existence. The course was taught by instructors from world renowned instructors, by the way, from the University of Southern California. And it was a fantastic course. And so I do have some flight safety experience. Fortunately, I never had to investigate an accident. But it would, I guess it would have been okay to do that, because that would have been nice for my resume. But, you know, honestly, I just like flying airplanes and doing podcasts and talk about flying airplanes and answering your questions. So I don't know what I'm going to do when I'm required to retire. And that'll be a little bit more than 10 years from now, age 65. But I don't know. Really, really don't know what I'm going to do. Hopefully, I've saved enough money where I can. I've told my wife what I know what I want to do, and I don't think she wants to do this with me. But I figure head down to the Florida beaches and just walk around barefoot, and you know, it doesn't take a lot of money. I could have a tent or something like that, and just drink beer and eat seafood and just hang out at the beach and sit in the sun and live the rest of my years. I don't know. Again, she's not a big beach person, and she's basically said, well, if you're going to do that, you're on your own. So, number three, Steve writes, have any passengers recognized you from your podcast? Well, if you've listened to the last, I don't know, I forgot what podcast it was on, but Justin, a Pinnacle Air pilot, was on one of my flights from, I think it was from either Detroit or Minneapolis to Memphis. And getting off the airplane, he said, "Are you, you're Captain Jeff. You're the one that has the Airline Pilot Guide podcast." I went, "Huh? What? Somebody actually recognized my voice?" And I said, "Yeah." And in fact, he's given us some feedback about that. So that's at least one person that's been on my airplane and recognized me for the host of this show. I've heard in the last several weeks while talking on frequency, when it's not my leg to fly and I'm the pilot monitoring and not the pilot flying, and so I'm talking on the radio, I've heard a couple little shout outs from people. I don't know if it's from people that I've flown with who are fellow Acme pilots, or if there are people who are flying for different carriers that recognize my voice from the podcast. So I'm not sure. I suspect that's the case, but I don't know for sure. And so he ends by saying, "Excellent job in the podcast. I find myself taking the long way to work to get as much in as possible, or maybe to avoid going to work." Nah, it's probably both. Nah, it's the podcast. I am now making my reservations for business trips on Acme solely due to your podcast. Ooh, a lot of pressure. Any airline that hires such an intuitive, calm, and thoughtful man such as yourself deserves my business. Thanks. You flatter me. It's a shame you can't mention your airline, although I can figure it out. I'm sure everyone can, because you're an asset to both your airline and the flying public as a whole. There is a beer with your name on it in PHL anytime. Awesome. I look forward to that. I'll look you up, Steve, when I head up to Philly the next time, or when I have a layover, that is. And we'll enjoy some beers and talk about flying. You know the old joke, you know what pilots do when they're on the ground? They talk about flying. That's what I'm doing now. Yeah, but when we're in the air, we talk about women. And that may or may not be true. Okay, moving on. Oh, let's play the sounds, right? Come on. Darn it. Come on, switch. That didn't give me enough time. Ah, I got to improve my system here. Okay, this is from Kevin St. John, who sent me feedback several times. He says, Aero News is reporting Acme is upgrading to EFIS and introducing GPS nav systems. Okay, well, we have EFIS screens in our cockpit already, but what he's talking about is, I think the company is called Innovative Solutions or something like that. They're going to be, or they have been contracted to do a major avionics upgrade to all of the MD-88s and MD-90s in our fleet. And it's going to be like these big screens, like the Garmin G1000s, the screens that you see in the 76400 and the 777, these big electronic flight screens, and side-by-side with, you know, there goes the old T arrangement of instrumentation where you're doing your cross-check. Somebody told me that with the more modern displays, you don't do the cross-check anymore. You just kind of stare at it. But a nice big navigation display, integrated radar and traffic collision avoidance system, information on the big screen, and GPS, which is important for next-gen, and ADS-B and TI, which I think stands for traffic information. So all kinds of good stuff. In fact, we're going to be one of the most modern cockpits out there when they complete the upgrade, which I think starts early next year and ends a couple years later. So he continues, "It looks like the MD-8890 series has some legs left as far as Acme is concerned." Yeah, I think so. He says, "How much training will be required for flight crews to be certified on this equipment?" Now, we haven't heard what the plan is at Acme as far as if we're going to be thrown into a simulator for a couple hours to kind of get up to speed with the new displays, or more than likely, I've been talking to my fellow Acme pilots about this, and they said, yeah, they'll probably just throw a CD or a DVD in our mailbox and tell you to pop it in your computer and train yourself. That's the world we live in now, is training CDs and, you know, I love the old days where you go into a classroom and you have a real instructor and real people that you could talk to and find out and learn information, but I guess it's just too costly now. And it's cheaper for our airlines just to give us a CD and pop it into our computer and do it on our own time. Although we do get a little bit of pay for doing that kind of training. But so I don't know. That's the answer. I don't know what ACME is going to have us do to get up to speed on those new cockpits. So I'll let you know when I find out. Thanks again, Kevin, for the feedback. Chris in Cartersville. He says, "Hello, Captain Jeff. This is Chris, a frequent listener and contributor. I have a friend, Crystal." Okay, this is from Chris. And he has a friend named Crystal who is interested in your podcast. And she has a brother, Christopher, who is also interested. Crystal also has a friend named Chrissy who is interested in becoming a pilot and would like to listen to your podcast. So I just wanted to let you know that I'm doing what I can to promote your show. Well, thanks, Chris. I appreciate it. I have just a few questions for today. I know that the retirement... Oh, before he asked the questions, he says, "I'm not sure why so many people with the name Chris or a similar sounding name are interested, but hey, it's all good." Yeah, Chris's and Brian's and some other very common names. And let me look here at my battery level on my recorder. Okay, we're doing okay, although it's getting close to the end. Got to make sure that I pay attention to that. Okay, so let's go on with your questions, Chris in Cartersville. I know that the retirement is a ways off. Hey, why is everybody asking about retirement? I know I look old. Gosh, I must sound old too and tired. Okay. I know that retirement is a ways off for you, but I was just curious as to what your thoughts were when you retire. To be a ground school or simulator instructor or something non-related to aviation. You know, I would love to be a teacher, ground school or simulator instructor, but as I mentioned just in the last email, that's going away. I mean, it's gone. There's nobody instructing in classrooms anymore in our world of airline flying. It's all, you know, computer-based training. Regarding the 787 pilots, while the plane is grounded, what do these pilots do? Do they go through a type rating for a different plane or just wait for the 787 to be cleared? Just curious. Well, I don't know for sure, and it probably depends on the airline, but I have a feeling that once you're trained on that 787, you know, like ACME, you don't fly anything else until you go back to training and get retrained on another airplane. So I have a feeling that because training is expensive for airlines, that these men and women who are trained 787 pilots are just enjoying life and not flying and getting their guarantees or minimum salaries. So what happens in the airlines is that when you are on reserve or something like this happens, there's usually a contract that you have with the company that says, well, if I don't fly so many hours, then I'm guaranteed at least to get this much money. Because, hey, the mortgage still has to be paid. The car payments, the college tuition, all that stuff still has to be paid. So you have to be confident that you're going to get some kind of compensation, even if you're not doing anything. So I absolutely do not know, but I have a feeling. Okay, sorry for the interruption there. We had some technical difficulties while I was in West Palm Beach. That was Wednesday. It is now Saturday morning. And it's been very busy here at the Nielsen house. My son flew home yesterday from Orlando. And my daughter came in the day before that. It's a big weekend because my daughter, I think I mentioned this in the first part of the show, my daughter Natalie is being confirmed this morning. So I am going to try to get some more of the show recorded and probably won't get it all finished, but I'm going to do my best to get as much as I can accomplished this morning. And then I'll finish it up sometime. Hopefully I have this thing out in the can and out for your consumption, I don't know, sometime this weekend, I hope. So, and I'd like to say, since we're kind of intermission period right now, for those of you who are joining us from the Airplane Geeks podcast, since the time I was recording on Wednesday night and now, I was able to listen to the latest episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. And I was the, I think I mentioned that earlier on the show, I was the guest on this week's episode, had a blast with Rob Mark and Max Flight. So check it out if you want. It's a great podcast. And so anyway, I had a lot of fun. All right, back to this show. I was reading feedback from Chris McDuffie, Chris in Cartersville, and I think that I had finished reading or answering the second part of his question. The last part, number three, have you ever broken in a brand new co-pilot? And if so, have you ever had one who was just so bad that you had to let the chief pilot know, etc.? Blue skies and tailwinds, Chris. No, I've never had one so bad that I had to talk to the chief pilot and say, no, you know, he's not going to cut it. Because, you know, usually by the time you get to the point where you have enough experience to get hired by Acme, you have, you know, you have a lot of experience. You've kind of been vetted. They do a pretty good job screening applicants. And so, I mean, you know, there are some pilots that are weaker than others, that's for sure. And I have flown with some that who are new to the airplane, either brand new to the airline, or perhaps they were bumped off another airplane and were now flying the MD-88, MD-90. And, you know, it's a learning experience. It's kind of a tough job to be a first officer on a two-pilot airplane, which I guess most airplanes now are, especially the 88-90 series, a lot going on in the cockpit. So I have flown with some that were, I had to really pay attention to what they were doing to make sure that we didn't screw something up, but nothing as bad as to warrant talking to the chief pilot. So thanks, Chris, for your feedback and your questions. Hopefully that answered everything you were asking about. This was sent in by Eric, and he said, I found this on the day that Jonathan Winters passed. I guess he just passed away recently. Jonathan Winters, a comedian. And he said, I thought you'd enjoy it. And it's a little video of black and white. It's pretty old. And apparently Jonathan Winters is playing a pilot. He's being interrogated. He must have done something wrong. And he's before an accident investigation board, as far as I can tell. So let us listen to a little bit of that, at least the audio of the video, and here we go.
This is Captain Harold Quimby. He has been a commercial airline pilot for 28 years. He is before a board of inquiry who will decide in the next few minutes whether or not he is still fit to continue as a pilot. That is why this man is a man under pressure.
All right, this hearing will now come to order. Now you realize, Captain Quimby, the purpose of this hearing is to determine whether you will be allowed to continue flying. Our decision, of course, will be final. Is that understood, Quimby?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How did you get into this business, Quimby?
Well, I just love to make model airplanes. I suppose that was the first thing I did. I just love to make them, and like any normal child, and I got excited. I read a lot of aeronautical magazines. And
relax, Quimby.
Sorry.
All right, you're flying.
I'm trying to. It's not easy, sir. I mean, this is the first time in my life I've ever been called up one of these darn things.
How long have you been flying?
I'm about 41 years.
How old are you?
41 years. 41 years of age.
I see.
All right, Quimby, here's a sample situation. Let's see how you handle it.
Yes, sir.
You're flying at 25,000 feet. The right starboard engine flings out. Your oil pressure is dropped below 2,500 cubics. What's your first move, Quimby?
Well, first thing, I would turn automatically to the co-pilot and get his reaction.
The co-pilot?
The co-pilot. Co-pilot, the man, the assistant, the man that takes two of us.
Right, how do you do that?
Takes two to tango, right? Well, it's the same thing in the air. I would turn to him and ask him if he could help me, because it's not always up to me. I'd certainly never ask a stewardess.
Okay, that's a little taste of the video. I'll have the link to the whole thing in the show notes. And Jonathan Winters was always a favorite of mine, a stand-up comedian. A lot of in a lot of different movies and shows back in the, I don't know, 50s, 60s, 70s. Anyway, may God bless his soul. We lost another great one. And let's hear from Carl Stebbings.
Hi, Captain Jeff. It's Carl Stebbings here from the UK in the small village of Ersham, just leaving you some voice feedback via SpeakPipe. So just listen to episode 63 of the Airline Pilot Guide podcast. Another fantastic podcast. So hats off to you, Jeff, for another brilliant podcast. I can't wait for the next one to be released on iTunes. So as I sit here, it's the 4th of April, coming up to 1:15 in the afternoon. So I'm getting ready to go to work at 2 o'clock, although my job's not quite as exciting as yours. So just going on from a few of your podcasts, just recently you've always mentioned the TriStar. One of my favourite aircraft is my favourite aircraft, and one which is sadly being kind of phased out now pretty much all round the world, sadly. Just watched a video on YouTube of the Las Vegas Sands Corporation's Lockheed L-1011 TriStar. They've got a 500 series. Watched a video on YouTube of the aircraft taking off from Stansted Airport here in the UK. And have to say that the noise from those Rolls-Royce RB211 engines is just something to die for. I think it's one of the best sounding engines I think ever produced, personally. And I was just looking on the planespotters.net website and just to see about the aircraft itself. And it's nearly 30 years old, the aircraft they use, but looks brand new. If you see the video on YouTube, you'll see for yourself it looks virtually brand new. So I guess, Jeff, I'm just asking, if at all possible, on one of your podcasts soon, if you've got any interesting stories or a sort of small snippet of your life. I think you're on the TriStar for 2-3 years, I think you said in your part of the podcast. Just a story or something about the TriStar, I think I would really enjoy, and I'm pretty sure the listeners would enjoy as well. So, from a very windy and cold UK, thanks, Jeff, for making a fantastic podcast, as always. And just as a special Easter gift to you, I've just popped some money in the cup of coffee fund you've got on your website, on the Airline Pilot Guy website. So treat yourself to a strong espresso on me, Jeff, or maybe a pint of real ale. Anyway, as always, Jeff, clear skies, tailwinds, and brilliant visibility as always. Take care, Jeff. Goodbye.
Well, thank you, Carl. And by the way, I've heard you sending feedback on some other shows like the Airplane Geeks. So that's great. And you're providing a lot of great content for a lot of different aviation shows out there. So, hey, before you know it, folks, you're going to hear Carl. He'll probably have his own show. Maybe we'll have to have him on this show sometime. You can be my co-pilot. And he said something about the coffee fund. Thank you for mentioning that, Carl. And let me play this.
Johnny, how much more coffee?
No, thanks.
That is my little coffee fund bumper. And, one of the things that happens when I'm at home and I'm not on the road, you'd think I'd be able to control the environment, the sound at least, a little bit better at home. But no, I'm in the basement, and the pipes from this half of the house drain right over the top of my head. So apparently somebody is upstairs using the facilities, and I do apologize for that. And anyway, let's move on. Carl mentioned the coffee fund. Thank you, Carl, for the Easter gift. If you want to donate to Captain Jeff's coffee fund, because I do love coffee, you can do that by pressing the button that says buy me a cup of coffee. And it's certainly appreciated. I appreciate everything that you guys do for me. Okay, so now let's go over here and play this right here. Oh, a little bit of stuttering there. Need to get that engine checked. Okay, so, before I move on with this, Carl, in Taiwan, I didn't answer your question, Carl Stebbings, in the UK. Any stories from the from the TriStar? You know, honestly, I really didn't think about it until I was listening to your audio feedback. Yes, you're right. I did fly it for a total of 3 years, 2 years domestically, and then 1 year internationally. And at that time, Acme was just using it for going to Honolulu, Hawaii. and also some of the other Hawaiian islands. But out of Atlanta, we were mostly flying it to Honolulu. And so it wasn't really international, but as far as our work rules were concerned, as far as our union is concerned, that's an international category. And honestly, I think that I enjoyed the domestic flying better on the L-1011 than the, quote, international, because, number one, I got a chance to head out to Los Angeles a lot more often to visit my family out there. And I don't know, you know, just staying within the continental United States and not having to go through all the time zones, heading over to the Hawaiian Islands was a little easier on me. You know, when we'd always have 24 hours off in Hawaii, and or approximately 24 hours off, and I never really knew exactly how to manage my circadian rhythm or recover from the destruction of it. By the time my favorite trip, we had three trips. One that was a 3-day nonstop from Atlanta to Honolulu, 24 hours off there, and then back the next night. All the flights leaving Honolulu were, as far as what we were flying in Atlanta, were all-nighters, backside of the clock type flying. And so that the 3-day, you know, after the 24-hour layover, then you'd fly the nonstop back to Atlanta, getting back here in Atlanta sometime early in the morning, like 6:30, something like that. And then it was always dangerous to get in my car and try to drive home after, you know, not sleeping at all for that flight. The two other trips, and I may have mentioned this before in earlier podcasts, were 4-day trips, 2 layovers. And we'd either go through Dallas-Fort Worth or San Francisco on the way out to Honolulu. And then, again, 24 hours off there. And then the next night, leaving Honolulu. Why is it so hard for me to say that? I don't know. Back to either Dallas or San Francisco, and then 24 hours off again, and then back to Atlanta on the fourth day. My favorite of those three trips was the San Francisco trip because, number one, I love the city of San Francisco, and number two, it was the shortest flight, the shortest all-nighter backside-of-the-clock flight of the three. And so it was the easiest on my body. And so that was my favorite. But if I flew that one, it was one that left Atlanta in the afternoon on the first day. And so, you know, I'd get up in the morning at the normal time. I'd be flying all day I'd show up to the airport in the afternoon, fly to San Francisco. You have about 90 minutes off in San Francisco. That in itself was kind of a long flight. And then go from San Francisco to Honolulu, another, you know, 4 or 5 hour flight. By the time you land in Honolulu, get on the crew bus to the hotel, you'd been up for at least 24 hours, or at least I had. And it was, you know, hard to recover from that. I remember most of my layovers in Honolulu, Waikiki, just kind of being in a fog. Like, you know, you just can't shake the cobwebs out of your brain. And whether I, you know, immediately took a 4-hour nap, or if I, you know, tried to sleep for a good 8-10 hours and then get up and walk around and then take a short nap before the all-nighter flight, or if I did that backwards, it just, I never seemed to figure out exactly what was the best for my body as far as the rest cycle, circadian rhythm, that kind of thing. But I'm sure that's not the kind of story you were asking about as far as the air. I'm sure you're more concerned about the airplane itself. And so I'm going to have to think about that a little bit, Carl. Again, I didn't prepare myself for any, you know, funny stories about the L-1011. A little odd, you know, I think it was just the Dash 1 model. We flew the Dash 1, the 250, and the 500 models. And I think it was maybe the Dash 1 and perhaps the 250, now I can't remember, had the galley that was below decks down the lower level, and there were lifts, two elevators or lifts that went down. And I do remember it was kind of odd when I first checked out on the airplane that one of the checklist items was that the flight attendants were up from the lower galley and in the main level of the airplane. And so that was actually a checklist item that we were ensuring that nobody was down in the lower galley. I've heard a lot of interesting stories about the lower galley and what did or did not occur down there, you know, over the years. Probably more true when we first got the airplane in the 70s. Everything was different in the world in the 70s. When I was flying it, it was in the mid 90s, and none of those stories, at least as far as I knew, were really true. I really don't want to go into it because it's kind of a family show. Again, I'll have to think a little bit more about the TriStar and any stories I might have, Carl. So thanks for making me think about it because, as you said, it's your favorite airplane, and I suppose it was mine too. So, okay, let us play another little number here. Okay, this is another Carl that sent in feedback, and this is Carl He in Taiwan. It says, I joined your show since Airline Pilot Guy number 57. I enjoy this podcast very much. I want to go back to your go back from your latest episode to the earliest so that I won't miss any interesting information from the captain. Yeah, thanks, Carl. I've been learning about aviation since I decided to become an airline pilot. Thus, I enjoy reading books about this career. In your previous episode, sorry I couldn't recall which, the book North Star Over My Shoulder, A Flying Life by Bob Buck was recommended for the audiences. Luckily, I've just bought this book from the internet and had begun reading it. Indeed, it's a book with interesting features for those who want to know not only about flying, but also a pilot's life. May I quote the following contents as a joke for all the audiences, he says. In the chapter talking about earlier airplanes used in airline companies, Buck wrote, even aside from the DC-3's marginal performance with an engine out, it wasn't that all good a flying airplane. We were practicing steep turns and got into one too slow and too steep. It flipped one wing up over the other and spun. Not for long, because I got to work quickly and recovered before it had developed seriously. The main damage was to the airplane's interior, more specifically to the toilet area. The maintenance crew was supposed to remove the honey bucket from the DC-3's lavatory, but they'd forgotten to do this, so as our G-forces went slightly negative when we flipped into the spin, the honey bucket's content dumped all over the lavatory interior and into the cabin as the lav door flew open in the chaos of the maneuver. The maintenance crew no doubt had great regrets about forgetting to take the buckets out as they cleaned up the mess. I'm sure that we're not going to hear any such stories today, are we? He writes. No, you're not. And I was just mentioning, I was trying to recall some of the stories from the TriStar, and we did not have a honey bucket on the TriStar. We had real bathrooms, well, real aircraft lavatories. Many of them, by the way. I think the C-130 in the Air Force had a honey bucket, as far as I recall from other people. I never flew that airplane, but the C-141... the transport airplane I did fly in the Air Force did have a regular kind of lavatory, not a honey bucket. So, ooh, that's kind of a nasty story. Okay, he goes on. Thank you, and also the audience on Airline Pilot Guy, very much for providing so many valuable information, thoughts, and resources on the podcast. Please keep up the good work. And someday, if you happen to stop by Taiwan, please do not forget to ask me about where to go sightseeing and cuisine eating. Best regards, Carl He. Thank you, Carl, for your feedback, and I do appreciate it. Continue listening and continue to send me feedback, and if I'm in Taiwan, I'll definitely look you up, I promise. All right, let's play this. Sorry, that was kind of loud, wasn't it? My bad. Okay, hi Captain Jeff, it's your friend Jonathan from Barbados again, hoping all is well with you. He just left Washington, D.C. last week. Sadly, I didn't really get to communicate to you beforehand to see if you'd be in the area. Were you? I don't think so. Just a few questions for you. How often do airplanes fly, as in one particular plane every day? Number two, is a pilot assigned to one particular plane? And number three, does the same plane fly the same route every day? These are all good questions, and the airplanes really fly more than the pilot and flight attendant crews do. because of course it's not, they're not subjected to rules as far as you know, how many hours they can work in a day. And it really depends on the airplane, the fleet. The airplane that I fly starts flying usually for most of the fleet anyway, early in the morning on those first flights, you know, the 5:30, 6 o'clock, 6:30 departures in the morning. And then it continues on flying through the evening, ending somewhere depending on the particular day and the particular flights assigned, probably sometime anywhere from about 9 o'clock at night through perhaps after midnight. So some of these airplanes are flying a good solid 12, 13 hours, and then others are probably flying 9 or 10 hours per day. So again, they fly a little bit more than the humans do. Now, there are some airplanes in the fleet that I'm sure even fly more than that. They just have to have enough time to be given some preventative maintenance by our mechanics and that kind of thing, periodic checks and all that kind of stuff. But they fly a lot. Number two, is a pilot assigned to any particular plane? No, other than just the type of airplane, the MD-88, MD-90, I'm qualified to fly that. I'm not qualified at this point to fly any other airplane because airplanes nowadays are just so much different or different enough as far as the systems are concerned, the procedures for operating it normally and abnormal situations, emergency procedures, different enough that we don't want to be confused. So we are trained on one airplane, and it may be a couple different versions of the airplane like the MD-88, MD-90, or the 757, 767. And if we want to move to a different airplane using the what I'd talked about before in earlier episodes about advanced entitlements, the way that we bid for different airplanes to fly or maybe different crew bases or whatever, then you will go to training. And training lasts anywhere from about a month, month and a half to 2-3 months, depending on the airplane that you're going to and whether or not you've had experience on it. So, and maybe it's not quite so long anymore because now a lot of our training, what we used to do is go to ground school and go to classrooms and get a lot of instruction that way. And now we get the CDs that we pop into our laptops or desktop computers, and we do a lot of the training that way. And then we just show up to the training center at the simulators for our actual simulator training from there. And that's usually 2, 3, 4 weeks, again, depending on the airplane and the type of training you're going to receive. And finally, does the same plane fly the same route every day? No, they're all over the place. Maybe some of the international airplanes are more likely to fly the same routes, but no, they pretty much rotate around and go and fly different routes throughout the system. Okay, well, it's that time for me to pause again. At least I knocked out a few of your questions and your feedback. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go ahead and just end this thing. I'm going out on a trip again on Monday morning. And I think on Tuesday I'll have a long enough layover to knock out another show. And so I think it's just best for me to end this one and save the rest of the feedback that I was going to cover on this show for the next episode. And thanks for hanging in there with me. I know this was kind of a discombobulated episode. If you're, again, new to this podcast, this is not the normal way this thing is recorded. It's just my life has been very, very busy lately, and I wanted to get a podcast out there because it's been a while, and I feel an obligation to do that to my devout listeners. But as I said, life just gets in the way of a lot of stuff, you know? And so continue to listen, continue to send in feedback, and as I like to say, wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.